is my field of study is facial perceptiveness, is mental disorders and rhinoplasty and quality of life, how the things we do affect the patient. So not much as a surgeon perspective, but more on the patient's perspective. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of the Rhinoplasty Podcast with me, Dr. Cameron McIntosh. We're in season three, where we're doing live interviews and coming to you directly from Berlin at the International Meeting of Global Masters of Rhinoplasty. And I'm very excited for today's episode because this is a man who I've been trying to track down for a while, has got some fascinating insights to rhinoplasty and the research that he does, etc. So a big warm welcome to Jem Bullitt. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited.
So Jem, yeah, man, there's so much to ask you about. Talk to me about sex and rhinoplasty.
Oh no, I thought we were skipping that part. Well, the thing that you're mentioning is that we looked into if sex with orgasm can actually have a positive effect on the nasal breathing. And it turns out that it has, and that it has the same effect for about an hour, the same as a nasal decongestant. So when we published it, it went crazy and won a few prizes, which were famous. So it made it to the media and then it got huge. So yeah, basically it's just physiology. I mean, yeah. Saying that when you have like a sportive activity, and sex is a sportive activity, a nice one with a special orgasm at the end. And that just has an effect on your nervous system, and it triggers certain receptors that cause your nasal mucosa to de-swell, like in the same way a nasal decongestant does. And so sometimes you don't even need a nasal decongestant, and there's some other solutions that you should consider.
So Jem, you know, one of the things that we've been chatting about is the whole like psychological and mental side of rhinoplasty.
Right.
Yeah. But before we climb into that, maybe just tell the listeners a little bit more about who you are, where do you come from, what do you do?
Yeah. Well, as I said, my name is Jem. I was born and raised in a town in Germany called Karlsruhe. I studied in Heidelberg, which is not far away. And my studies and clinical research took me all over the world, but I always came back to Heidelberg, and I'm working currently in Mannheim. So what I focus on is my field of study is facial perceptiveness, is mental disorders and rhinoplasty and quality of life, how the things we do affect the patient. So not much as a surgeon perspective, but more on the patient's perspective. So I'm using a lot of patient reported outcome measures. We're validating them. We're getting new ones just to make sure that our patients are getting hopefully the best treatment they can have. So we're evaluating all the time and see what we can do better.
Yeah, but I mean, you're very into research and stuff, but you're still operating. I mean,
that's my main part.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. So that's my main part. Yeah. So I have my our focus group at the University of Heidelberg, where I'm a professor, and I'm doing rhinoplasty and facial plastic surgery. That's the main thing. Yeah, but it's a nice combination. I like both, and I like the combination.
And just to add more stuff to your plate, married to a cardiothoracic surgeon.
I am,
and kid and another kid on the way.
Right, that's correct. Yes, that's correct. Very exciting. So we'll see what the future brings.
And you were telling me that you actually initially thought you were going to specialize in a different field of medicine.
Yeah, I actually wanted to do a cardiothoracic surgery as well. I was very excited. I did my doctoral thesis in thoracic surgery. I went to Baylor, to University of Texas Heart Institute, and trained with Dr. Cooley and Dr. Duncan, so very famous surgeons for cardiothoracic and in the specialty. And the question that comes up is, why didn't I pursue in this field? And it's difficult to say. It's just the so we come back again to quality of life. So in Germany, it's very rare to talk and see a cardiothoracic surgeon who's genuinely happy with his life and the quality of life that they have. And that was a consideration that I took in a very early stage in my career, to not go into the field that I actually really adore. I still adore facial plastic surgery. I love everything I do.
Yeah.
But at the beginning, I was tending more towards cardiothoracic surgery and pediatric surgery, because like seeing the heart transplant or a little heart beating from a child, I think it was the most fascinating thing I ever experienced in my life. And it was hard letting go, but I don't regret it.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
And I know off air we were chatting a little bit about like body dysmorphic disorder
Yeah,
and difficult patients and
huge
stuff.
part.
I think I want to hear more about that.
Well, so in the last few years, my research is more on mental disorders and psychiatric disorders that can affect our patients, and it's anxiety, depression, and as you mentioned, body dysmorphic disorder. We all, everyone, everybody has, we talked about that yesterday, everybody has this one patient that they missed with the diagnosis of BDD, and it's just so energy consuming and so exhausting, and it can, if you fail to detect this kind of mental disorder, it's not just an unhappy result for the patient, but it's unhappy result for the surgeon as well. It can be devastating, and it can ruin your career. It can ruin your personal life, and you can't sleep if you're thinking about the patient and get messages or calls every 5 seconds, every 5 minutes. So it's also something that to protect the surgeons that should know about. So what we found out is that BDD patients don't do very well in sense of quality of life gaining after surgery. They are impaired and they start with a lower quality of life before surgery. So they really suffer. They really, really, really suffer. It's a disease. And this is nothing new. I mean, somewhere around 1860, a professor from Italy, Morselli, found this disease, and he called it dysmorphobia. And he said that these patients are truly miserable. This is one of the quotes that lasted for over 150 years now.
Yeah.
And there is actually treatment for that, like cognitive behavioral therapy or a medication, actually. These patients don't do well after surgery. So they might have slight defects or flaws, but they tend to overestimate it. And they really, it's difficult to treat them because you can't really win. Even if you treat their nasal symptoms, they're still going to, because rhinoplasty is so much more than just treating the nasal airway. It's about mental health. It's about self-consciousness, general symptoms. And all that taking in consideration, you sometimes don't help these patients.
And what's your advice to the listeners about trying to not get these patients on the one hand, but the other hand is, once you've got that, how do you as a physician, what kind of stuff would you say is a good way to protect your own mental health?
Well, I'm always evolving, so I wouldn't consider myself an expert who has finished, who's done this training for 60 years and knows how to treat every patient. Most people say, trust your gut feeling. That's what you, when you hear the American surgeons talking about their 60 years of experience. But some people don't have that gut feeling. If you haven't done 50,000 surgeries before, you don't have this gut feeling. And gut feeling is, as research shows, always something that you experience before. So you have to experience certain stuff to get this gut feeling.
You gotta pay your dues, eh?
Everybody does this mistake. I also operated on patients that I shouldn't have, and everybody, every surgeon who really would probably answer the question the same way, that you missed some part of physical of psychiatric disorders that you should have probably noticed. But my advice is, because it's my field of study, and if you want to read more into it, if you have problems with that, expert in the worldwide expert is Catherine Phillips, and she's written an excellent book called The Broken Mirror. So if you're interested in this field,
so that you'll be able to get that on Amazon or whatever. The Broken Mirror.
I don't have any disclosure. I don't get any money. It's just
But who is she?
Catherine Phillips is a professor currently, I think, in the U.S., and she specialized in body dysmorphic disorder, and especially in surgery and body dysmorphic disorder. And and she published the most cited manuscripts in this area, actually. So what she tells you is that you probably many people that would tell you is, if you as a surgeon feel like there is somebody who has body dysmorphic disorder and you want to let them go, well, first of all, you can actually try and tell them that there's something wrong, but this is really, they don't want to hear that most of the time. So you have to say that you understand them, and you have to agree that they're suffering. You have to see that they're suffering. So a good way is to try and maximize your empathy, saying, I understand that you have a problem, and I understand that you're really, really suffering, but must be hard for you. And this is a good start off to get a connection between the patient and you, even if you have a different goal. If you just want to, I don't want to operate, I just want her or him gone, but still, this is a good way to empathy. And you could talk about possible therapies that they could actually get and gain from that. And if you don't want to get the surgery, we just had this talk over the last weeks with other master surgeons, and they said actually that they don't use the word "I don't want to operate," "I don't want to do your surgery." Is just like try to let them down in a different way, saying, "I don't have the skills to do your surgery." More on this way. I don't know if it's the right answer. I don't know. Probably Catherine Phillips would probably disagree, Yeah, most people actually seek help. So there are some who went through a lot of surgeons and know how to get their way to surgery. But most of them actually, there are also some people who actually seek help.
Yeah.
And they're not unhappy that you, but if you don't know the disease, if you don't know the conditions and how it represents, you probably won't catch it.
And okay, different question now. Jim, what is for you the most challenging thing in rhinoplasty?
The most challenging part in rhinoplasty is filtering the patients that I shouldn't do surgery on.
Really?
Yeah.
And okay, so how many, say, of 100 patients who come requesting rhinoplasty, would you say you have a conversion rate of how many will end up being on the table?
Did I want?
Not that you want, but normally if there's 100
people. Okay, so if I turn them down or they turn me down.
Yeah. What would you think? Because it's interesting. I think at the early on in your career, when a patient walks in the door requesting, they're going to get it.
Yeah.
But later on in the career, it's not quite as much. Yeah. But I'm interested to hear from your side what
I would say you've done in 60%.
60%, eh?
Probably, but that's just out of my head.
Yeah.
But early in my career, I would say probably more.
Yeah.
I wouldn't filter because I still love doing surgery, but I would try and get more surgery done. And now I have more options to filter. And use these words that I just described, like, I'm probably not the best for you.
Yeah.
I don't have the right skills for you or something like that.
And tell me, let's touch on a bit of social media and mental health, et cetera, for patients as well, because there's this massive pressure and it's all these selfies that distort your face and that's the nose you want. And
it's difficult. There's actually interesting studies showing that if people come with other pictures from social media and they tend to say, I want this nose, or can you do it like that? That these patients in the study show they have less quality of life after surgery, even if it went well. So these patients, I don't know what the psychiatric issue exactly is, but if you tend to look at too many pictures and compare them too much, it doesn't help your quality of life, and you don't see the result that you actually gained, and more see the negative part of what you probably didn't gain. So you see more the flaws than the gain. And overall, you don't have the quality of life gain that you could have if you didn't compare yourself to others. But that, I guess, is not just in rhinoplasty, but you could emphasize that in other parts of your life.
Sure. And how do you see your rhinoplasty progressing over the next while?
Well, surgery-wise, I'm generally a happy guy, but I always try to get better and learn stuff. So I go to Istanbul to Göksel a lot to see and do new stuff. If I read a lot and I try and see different surgeons and adapt what I think would be good for my practice. I learn a lot from my colleague and friend Frank Riedel, who is one of my main mentors and probably the mentor that I have. So I'm very grateful that I just met so many people that actually helped me for my career and to become the surgeon that I want to be, but I'm not there.
No, I don't know.
I don't. I always want to be better and improve.
Okay, so last thing I want to ask you about, chat about a little bit, is patient-related outcome measures.
Yeah.
So have you designed any? Do you test your patients beforehand?
Yeah, we do them. We do them. I mean, it's interesting. So at the beginning, the patient reported outcome measures are gaining more and more importance. Yeah. It's not just you cannot just show pictures of the cases that before and after. I mean, you can do that on social media, but if you want to really do it evidence based, you need some sort of patient reported outcome measures, and it's gaining more and more importance, especially in aesthetic surgery, where the feeling of the patient should be the best outcome that you can actually measure and get. So it started around 20 years ago, and one of the first patient-reported outcome measures was from Al Saraf from the United States, and it was called the Rhenoplasty Outcome Measure. It was a basic one consisting out of 6 questions, but mainly the most of them are just aesthetic questions. So very rare function questions, so and very rare mental self-consciousness questions. So it was a first start, but it doesn't emphasize the whole surgery and the whole change that the patient is going through. So we validated a questionnaire. We invented and validated a questionnaire. We designed one. It's called a functional rhinoplasty outcome inventory. We started with 22 questions in the alpha version. We did the whole psychometric and validation process, and 17 questions turned out to be important. So we're using that. So the higher the score is, the less quality of life you have. So the gain, so the aim is in the surgery to actually get the score lower, so you have more quality of life. There are actually like 20, 30 patient-reported outcome measures in the last 10 years. There is the Schnauss, there's the Utrecht questionnaire.
Yeah.
So everyone has their pros and cons, the face cue. Depending like who promotes them, and but there's 4 or 5 questionnaires that are really validated and are really good, and these are the ones that you could use. In Germany, for example, if you're in a private practice, sometimes you have to have a quality circle, so you have to prove that you are actually validating the quality of your surgery and your work, and this is an excellent tool where you can have it, you can do research with it, and you can even work on yourself. Why is this patient not satisfied? What can I do? And then you have to look, you have to be self-critical. And if you adapt all these, then I think actually it doesn't just help the patient, it also helps the surgeon to become a better version of himself.
Yeah. Jeez. Jim, it's so inspiring, man. It's good to see you sit here and talk to guys actually pushing the envelope, trying to really get academic, but having the humility of saying, how can I get better?
Yeah.
You know, true. Fantastic.
That's true.
So thank you, man.
Yeah,
thank you.
I love what you're doing, man. I love how you pursue in this academic career and how you teach and teach and teach. I cannot say I've met anybody who's so dedicated to this as you are. It's really an inspiration seeing what you're doing, your podcasts, your webinars during a difficult COVID time, and continuing this education. I want to thank you for doing everything. It's really inspiring, and you're doing a great job. Please continue.
Cool, man. Thank you.
Thanks for
guys, thank you for listening, and come back again next week for another episode of the Rhinoplasty Podcast.
Thanks for having me.